Hello, everyone, and welcome to another week of the podcast. This week, I interview Catherine Saluha, who just released her most recent book of poetry, Point of Entry, from University of New Mexico Press. And in this episode, we get to hear her recite two poems from her work. For me, both poems are gorgeous, and they reference specific, at least to me, magical times in her ancestors' lives. And I was just absolutely astonished at how she's able to combine these really exceptional events within the realm of poetry and just do it so beautifully. So I'm so excited for you to hear her recite these two poems. Also, weirdly enough, what made me really excited this week was she brings up Delmonico's, and one of her ancestors around the turn of the last century was a sous chef at this restaurant. And it kind of just, my jaw just dropped, because Delmonico's is famous. Not only were several groundbreaking recipes created at this restaurant, including Delmonico potatoes and potentially chicken a la king, but it was also New York's original restaurant. And so if you were someone who wanted to be seen, or you wanted to see those who were in the know or those who were famous, you went to Delmonico's. It is such a landmark. It's so famous. I can't even tell you the amount of fictional books I've read. They take place in New York, and Delmonico's is one of the characters. So when Catherine told me the story of her ancestor working at Delmonico's, it kind of made my entire year. At any rate, this entire interview from Soup to Nuts was just such a joy, and I hope you love the two poems that Catherine shares, and also love the beautiful stories of the magic and the miracles that have shown up in not only her life, but her ancestors' lives as well. So now, episode 132 of Bite-Sized Blessings.
My sister was pregnant, very pregnant, towards the end of her pregnancy when my mother fell down the stairs. She was due in May with her first child, and she had come home because very, very sadly, her husband had cheated, you know, had an affair and walked out on her. So they were separated, and my sister had moved home. I mean, it was, you know, all very, very sad and devastating for the whole family. Anyway, but my sister lived at home and was very pregnant. And in fact, the night my mother fell down the stairs, when I heard the someone falling, I was thought it was my sister, you know, who was becoming pretty pregnant. Anyhow, it was my mom. And when my mom was recovering, she told us a story that while she was, you know, unconscious in her coma, she heard a voice. She remembered it completely clearly. It sounded like a man's voice to her that spoke to her and said, "This isn't your time yet. Your granddaughter will need you."
Who are you as a human being? How do you self-describe?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. And the very first time I read it in your email, and still now, the main thing that comes up for me is that I am a person of service. Like, I believe that was my soul's purpose, in a sense. You know, I think I came in that way. Not to say that that's all I do by any means. I'm no saint. But the idea of service, you know, serving others, serving the community has always been and was a guiding force in my life. And I think was a family value I was raised with also. So it's no surprise that I'm in healthcare. And when I had my astrology chart read, a few times ago, but by a newer person to me. You know, I didn't say a word about anything about myself. And just by looking at my chart, he said, there's a high likelihood that you're in healthcare, you know, by looking at my chart, whatever that was. So that's, you know, defined me as a person and is definitely a big part of my self-image and is something that brings a lot of gratification, you know, and meaning to my life.
And I was going to ask, what do you do in healthcare exactly?
I'm a pediatric nurse practitioner. And I've always worked in pediatrics. I was a pediatric nurse first for 7 years and then went back to graduate school to become a nurse practitioner. But I just celebrated my 40th anniversary in healthcare in May. Yeah, I know. That's like, but something I don't usually say anything about that at all. But somehow this year, I don't know, it felt like sort of a landmark moment somehow or number. I've been talking about it more. Like I just decided I was going to acknowledge it more, especially after the pandemic, you know. So I'm a nurse practitioner. I work in a pediatric clinic, like an outpatient clinic. I do everything that a pediatrician would do on the clinic side, you know. Not, I don't work in the hospital anymore.
I think that takes, you know, I think it takes a very brave human being to work in the medical field in any kind of space, but especially with kids, right? Because they're so sweet and innocent, and I would imagine it's super challenging to see them when maybe they're scared or they're hurt or whatever. How do you deal with that? How do you engage with that?
Yeah. Well, because it really does feel like a calling to me. I mean, I remember the moment when I encountered the call, so to speak, you know, when I was very young. It really, I don't know how else to say it, except it really seems like my life's work, you know, my life's purpose in terms of a career. So not to say that there aren't challenging moments or when toddlers are really cranky or, you know, I've been spit on and kicked and thrown up on and, you know, at times that's only the minority of times, but all those things have happened. Had parents get really unhappy with me because of things I was telling them. But seeing children, you know, in pain or, you know, very ill, seriously ill, and also dying has actually, for me, honestly, Kirsten, I feel like it sounds, I don't know how it sounds, but it's just my truth. It's really been an honor for me. It's always felt like an honor. Like I feel honored that at this moment in time, I've been allowed to be there to perhaps add some level of comfort, you know, or healing or witnessing, you know, to that moment. So honestly, I love it, you know, and I'm getting older, I'm getting tired. I'm not to say that I'm not tired, very tired at the end of a day, but that part is just part of the process and is maybe what drew me to it, you know, is a sense of being able to make a difference.
Can I ask, if it isn't too personal, how old were you when you had this call?
I was 20.
And were you surprised?
I was a little surprised. I wasn't totally surprised. When I was young, really, my mother was a nurse, I should say. My mother was a nurse, and that definitely impacted me when I was young. But in the moment when I kind of felt this calling, so to speak, I wasn't thinking about that, or I didn't make any connection to that. When I was younger, I had actually thought maybe I'd be a physician, because I think healing, I just have this instinctual sense that healing is something that's gone back in time in my ancestors or something. So I thought maybe I'd become a physician. Then when I became a teenager, I was also studying the piano, classical piano, intensively. And I really, you know, as I became a teenager, I really thought I was going to be a musician and, you know, or music was going to be my life in some way. So when kind of the call happened, it did sort of surprise me, but it was, it was undeniable.
I wanted to, you know, my second question always is, did you grow up in a religious household? What did that look like for your family?
Yeah. Yes, I definitely did. Definitely in my, I mean, I did, and more powerfully so in my younger years. My parents are first generation Italian American, both my parents. My heritage is 100% Italian, or 92% by my genetic assay. So we were, no surprise, Roman Catholic, you know, and I was raised very much in the Catholic Church and was really good with that for a very long time. It meant a lot to me. We used to go to Mass as a family when I was little, pretty much every Sunday. We used to pray together as a family on occasion. Then I'm the youngest of four. So I think that held sway more powerfully, in a sense, for my older siblings. They went to parochial high schools. But by the time my parents got down to me, some things were changing, I think, for them. My mother was always a highly spiritual person, but I think she didn't feel as much need to keeping on going to Mass, you know, maybe as we all got older, and my father as well. But interestingly, my father shared with me, he had told me once, and then honestly, just about on his, almost his deathbed, honestly, he told me again that he had always really wanted to go into the priesthood. Like his true heart's desire. I mean, which is a very fascinating thing to hear as the fourth child of this person, you know. But that's what he told me. So it says a lot about what religion and spirituality meant to him.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's intense. I mean, what are you supposed to do with that information? But I also think it speaks really to his love and his passion for his God and it's interesting because I guess for his whole life, his heart lived in the tension in that space between, you know, family and kiddos and all of that. And, you know, his love for God and his beloved, you know, just where his heart was. Not that it wasn't with his family, but it's interesting that he was able to reconcile in between that space, those two loves.
I have to say, I don't know if he did reconcile. I would like to say he did. I'm not sure he did, really, Kirsten. I'm not sure he really did. I think he always seemed sort of like a man, you know, sort of more like the other side of that, you know, somewhat torn, you know, divided heart, you know.
I mean, did you have any sense when you were a kid that he was, you know, struggling with this or engaging with it?
Not at all. I mean, I knew my father had his challenges my father was clearly struggling with other things. He was the only child, the only surviving child of a very, very domineering, powerful, forceful, incredible Sicilian father. But so he was struggling with a lot of things. So no, as a child, I didn't know it was about that. Sometime I feel like, you know, as a young adult, I know maybe in my 20s, he shared that with me at some point. And then again, you know, literally right before he passed, that was really what he always wanted to do. But his mother forbid him from doing it, which, you know, as a Sicilian, you know, mother is also kind of hard to get your head around. but he was her only child. So I don't know, because my grandmother, she's my namesake, Catherine, and she passed before I was born. So I don't know what was going on for her, but my guess could only be, you know, she wanted grandchildren, or, she could see. I mean, it was obvious he was going to be her only child. She lost two other children. And so I guess, I mean, I don't know. That would be my only guess of why she would forbid him, because it kind of goes against what you might think is the stereotype, you know, for an Italian family to have a priest in the family, you know.
Sometimes I ask this question just because I love food so much, but when you were growing up and going to church, and was the Sunday meal like a big deal at your house? And what did that look like?
Yeah, no, it definitely was. And food in general, you're right on it. And also being a little intuitive, but food in general. Yeah, we would, when I was little, definitely before I became a teenager, we had like Sunday afternoon dinner, you know, like 2 o'clock, kind of the big meal, you know, that classic kind of old school way. So we'd go to mass and come home and have, you know, my mom would finish preparations or whatever, and we'd have dinner. And the only, and it was usually just, sometimes there was extra family members, but it was our family, our, you know, main family of six. As we all became teenagers, and especially, you know, I was the youngest, you know, we all started getting busy on the weekends, and you know, it started being, we'd be resisting that. Oh, mom, can't we have dinner tonight? You know, we wanted to go be with our friends or whatever. But as a kid, we definitely did. And all of our holidays were that way, you know, like sort of in the afternoon, our holiday dinners. And food was huge. I'm a very big cook myself. I can track back 3 to 4 generations of very, very excellent and big cooks. And in fact, in my poetry book, which I'm very sneakily now mentioning, my new book, Point of Entry, one aspect of that book is many of my ancestral stories. And one of the main figures emerged to be my great grandmother, Enrichetta Cavignolo, who was a sous chef in the famous restaurant called Delmonico's in New York City. I don't know if you've ever heard of it. Like maybe one of the, I mean, probably, I think there's a good likelihood the very first woman sous chef, or one of the first, because it was like around 1900. Yeah.
Okay, that's amazing.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
I don't know if many of my listeners know, but Delmonico's is epic. It's just this historic restaurant. And what's really fascinating is it's so historic and epic, and such a pivotal spot in New York history, and in early New York, right? Like the place to be, the place to be seen, the place to see, be seen, who was cool, who was in, who was out, movie stars, a lot of novelists, they use Delmonico's in their books, fiction, nonfiction, whatever, because it was such a landmark. So the fact that you're grandmother was there and working there is astounding to me. That is unbelievable. She must have been amazing.
I believe she was a force to be reckoned with. Yes, I believe she was. I mean, and for the time and the way she did that, you know, gained entry into that place was pretty incredible.
I mean, I'm just kind of flabbergasted right now, because first of all, her name is epic. I mean, and the way you say it, the way you say her name, it is so beautiful.
Enrichetta Cavignolo.
It's amazing. And, you know, I think, if I'm understanding correctly, a woman in the kitchen at that time, especially a kitchen like that, is groundbreaking. Or was groundbreaking.
Definitely. I mean, I cannot historically verify for you that she was the first one, but she had, if she wasn't the first, she was the second. you know, but she could have been the first. I was raised with the story that, you know, a woman had never been in the kitchen, you know, in a formal position. So it's probably pretty true for the time. It's not, doesn't feel like a stretch of the imagination.
And I think what you said earlier, that you have some of her recipes, because you said recipes, or no, you said you have cooks, three or four generations of chefs, of cooks, mm-hmm. not necessarily yeah. recipes.
But I do have her recipes that she passed to her daughter, my grandmother, Serafina, that my mother made, that my older sister made, that I make, and that now my daughter makes. Yeah, definitely.
Amazing. Can I ask what your favorite recipe is?
Oh, absolutely. Hands down. But that isn't a recipe of Enriqueta. It's my favorite recipe, which actually I have two poems in my book dedicated to this item. Is it Sicilian stuffed artichokes or carciofo that my Sicilian, that's my paternal grandfather made. And I adore that. I still love them. Everybody who knows me closely knows I love them, but that was my favorite food. Like, just like in that movie, My Big Fat Greek Wedding, you know, when she's bringing moussaka for lunch, you know, when she's little. In first grade, literally, and the teacher would go around and say, okay, everyone, what's your favorite foods? You know, call out the items. And kids were like, hot dogs, pizza, hamburgers. I'd be like, artichokes. And everybody would look at me like, what are you talking about? Nobody knew what stuffed artichokes were in my class at school.
I love that story. And I just would have loved to have been a fly on the wall at your Sunday dinners, I guess, early dinners. I would have so loved to have been a fly on the wall. I love cooking, but I really, really love the history of cooking. Mm. So, you know, I do buy cookbooks that just have recipes, but I really love cookbooks that are old, that have stories, that maybe tell the story of place, that tell the story of a time. I can't get enough of it. And I might never cook anything from that cookbook, but I just love discovering the history of food and place. And then the people who created those recipes, I just find it utterly fascinating. So I'm still like kind of in awe right now about the Delmonico's thing. Because I mean, the things that happened in that kitchen, I can't even imagine. And that your great grandmother was privy is just, I hope you have a lot of great stories, from that time and from your great grandmother.
Yeah, I do. I do have a good handful. That's how my great grandparents met, was in that kitchen. Yeah. So that's how I came to be, you know, so very indelibly part of my lineage. And in terms of a cookbook, my mother wrote a cookbook like that. It was never published, but I have it, and one day I can show it to you if you want. You'd probably love it. So she tried to get it published, but she was getting older and ill. But she wrote a beautiful cookbook, really, really just as a legacy for her children, for us, but with many, many of these stories that I then have woven into poems are written in that book. So sometimes I would go back and consult the stories in there, and I use her, reference her recipes all the time. I don't know what to do now. So there's a poem, there's a poem in the book that I had intended, you know, when we were emailing, that I wanted to read for you, that talks about, you know, a magical, you know, miraculous kind of event that happened to my grandmother, Enriqueta's daughter. But I'm also kind of torn because I have a poem about Enriqueta and Pasquale meeting in Delmonico's kitchen. All right, so I'll read Enriqueta's poem first. This is the one about Delmonico's, and then the other one. And I guess a little bit of the setup is Enriqueta was 18 and betrothed in Italy, in northern Italy, in the Lake Country. They're from a little tiny village called Mesansana, that's very close to Lago Maggiore. And she was betrothed. and to someone she did not want to marry, but the betrothal occurred. And then also miraculously, for like whatever that was, maybe 1890, she somehow convinced her father to allow her to go to New York just for the summer, you know, as a little fling, that she had family there, and stay with them before coming back and getting married in the fall. And somehow her father agreed. So that's where this poem starts. The title is, "I am told their marriage was arranged." Her father agreed to the voyage to appease the daughter whose future was settled. The seas rough that spring, she spent most of her time below deck. A clear broth and the finest hand-rolled orbs of meat. Pasquale delivered the eggs every morning. She had moved on to pastry by then. Relaxed fingers and loose wrist make an excellent whisk. Her chafed hands difficult to hide at dinner. Kidney beans soaked in caldo, secret of her grandmother's soup. The maitre d' placed a placard in the window. She never dreamed a woman would be considered. Her osso buco caught the chef's attention. Her aunt noticed the raw hands, but kept her questions to herself. Late summer, letters arrived. Filia, quando torni? Enriqueta inquired discreetly about the young man who delivered the eggs. So Pasquale was the man who delivered the eggs and the chicken. Oh my gosh,
I love that. I love that. Oh, she sounds dashing and brave. I love it.
She was absolutely very strong and very brave. That's documented in many ways within the family. Okay, so I will hop over to the other poem I wanted to share with you, which is more about a, you know, magic and miracle, but a story. This is a story I grew up with, and it's just pretty much exactly, it was told to me pretty much exactly the way it's going to be presented here. So this is my grandmother, Serafina, Enriqueta's daughter, my maternal grandmother. My grandmother told the story this way. She was flying above the Palisades, watching the colors of sunset fall over the river. She could see the entire valley and the way the river sliced through the land. My grandmother jumped awake. All seemed quiet in the house. The clock my grandfather carried from Luino ticked softly above the stove, his sleep breathing syncopated to the ticking. The lights of a passing car outside the window briefly lit up the walls of their room. And there, at the foot of their bed, a soft, radiant figure, a woman wrapped in a translucent blue cloak. The air around her seemed to glow. My grandmother was certain she smelled roses. The woman called softly, "Sera, Sera," in a voice so familiar, a northern Italian lilt. She had never been so awake. She felt the air on her skin prickling. She remembers the heater cycling on, my grandfather shifting slightly in his sleep. "Your brother will be healed. He is safe," the glowing woman at the foot of the bed told her. And that was all. My grandmother blinked and rubbed her face and watched as the figure dissolved into the floral wallpaper and the sapphire light from the window. In the morning, the telegram arrived.
Wow. I mean, that sounds like, with the blue cloak, it sounds like Our Lady.
That's what it sounded like to me. And I think my grandmother believed her. This was like World War One era. Mm-hmm. And her brother, her only living sibling, had been injured overseas on the battlefield, but not, you know, not mortally. He was wounded and in hospital. And that, you know, a day or two later, they received a telegram letting them know, you know, just that he'd be okay, but he was in the hospital.
Wow.
So I grew up, I was really young. I mean, you know, I thought of that story. There are others in my family, but that was the one, a powerful one. I was probably 4, 5, or 6, you know, when my mother began telling us that. I recall her telling my mother telling that story.
I think I love that you're using poetry to tell some of these stories, because, you know, these events that happen in our lives that are so magical and seminal and have the potential to change everything or shift our concept of what reality is, they're kind of lyrical, they're groundbreaking. And I think poetry is a really perfect way to kind of encapsulate that magic or try to contain it, because poetry can be subversive, it can be unexpected, it can be lyrical. It can be anything that the creator wants it to be, but a really gorgeous framework for these stories. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for saying that. Yeah, it just seemed, I started to realize I really needed these stories to be documented in some way. I mean, some of them, not this one, a number of the stories, especially about how my great grandparents met, are in my mother's cookbook. But there are other stories and from the other side of the family that are very important to me. And I agree with you, you know, poetry is lyrical and actually magical and surreal itself. You know, poetry, I just heard a poet say, you know, if the heart or the soul could write, it would write poetry, or when it writes poetry. And so these sorts of events, you know, these kind of magical, you know, mystical, whatever moments are something that go beyond our linear thinking, certainly. So I agree. They seem like a good meeting ground. I have another, you know, magical, sort of miraculous story that this was very powerful. When I, a turning point of my childhood, sort of the end of my childhood, I call it, I was around 15, and my mother fell down our basement stairs, you know, fell all the way down a whole flight of stairs and landed, you know, basically on her head on the cement floor. Yeah, I mean, she, you know, she, for 48 hours, I didn't know if she was going to survive. Yeah, it was, you know, she was almost mortally wounded. She had a subdural hematoma, which back in, you know, in the day is known to be something you know, you have slim chances of surviving. Broke her clavicle, you know, broke inner ear bones. I mean, many, many horrible things happened. She was in a coma for 48 hours. And back then, this was in the mid 70s, they literally said to us, you know, well, you know, we'll see, you know, they, that was sort of for the first 48 hours, that's what they were giving us in terms of her survival. So it was an incredibly traumatic moment in our family and it, why I call it the end of my childhood. I mean, in many other ways too, but she did wake up, thank God, and came home and had to, you know, recuperate. So she was in bed for a while, and sometime maybe a month or so after she was already home but still in bed, she told us this story. My sister at that time, my older sister, she was old, 8 years older than me. My sister was pregnant, very pregnant, towards the end of her pregnancy when my mother fell down the stairs. She was due in May with her first child, and she had come home because very, very sadly, her husband had cheated, you know, had an affair and walked out on her. So they were separated and my sister had moved home. I mean, it was, you know, all very, very sad and devastating for the whole family. Anyway, but my sister lived at home and was very pregnant. And in fact, the night my mother fell down the stairs, when I heard the someone falling, I was thought it was my sister, you know, who was becoming pretty pregnant. Anyhow, it was my mom. And when my mom was recovering, she told us a story that while she was, you know, unconscious in her coma, she heard a voice. She remembered it completely clearly. It sounded like a man's voice to her that spoke to her and said, "This isn't your time yet. Your granddaughter will need you." And back then, if we roll back to the mid-70s, you know, ultrasound was barely available. It wasn't even really being done, certainly not on any kind of routine way. Back then was the time of, you know, people just waited to be surprised on what, you know, what the gender of their baby was, right? Gender reveal and all that, you know, didn't exist, right? So, you know, you just waited. So we had no idea what my sister was having. But this voice told my mother, it isn't your time, your granddaughter will need you. And so 2 months later, my niece was born. My sister had her daughter, her oldest child. But it wasn't right then. My sister was still living with us. But about a year later, when my niece turned one, my sister was diagnosed with Hodgkin's disease. And became very, very ill. And my mom was much recuperated from her, you know, traumatic injury. And my mom, and me too, somewhat helped to raise my niece at that time, you know, when my sister was in treatment. So that was the sort of the fulfillment of these words that my mother heard. But that, you know, remained a great mystery and a miracle. And of course, I was incredibly grateful I didn't lose my mother at 15.
It seems just to me that both lineage, all these lineages, right, of the family tree, and I would use the word touched, but I mean in the very best way, touched by a close connection to spirit or the divine or the energy in the universe, to God, whatever language one wants to use, it seems like your family is very powerfully connected to that. Would you agree?
Yes. Yes, I would agree. And certainly, I think in general, but certainly through the maternal line, you know, certainly, or the women, I want to say, not to say the men weren't, but maybe the women just shared it more, you know, or talked about it more.
That's amazing because, you know, I interview quite a few guests who their ancestors, especially the women, you know, had these gifts or had these experiences, but never talked about them because it wasn't allowed. It was completely frowned upon, shut down. I don't know if they were scared that people would judge them. Of course they probably were, but it was like these little hidden secrets in the family of these powerful women who maybe could heal or talk to spirits or had unexplained events happen in their lives, but they never, ever talked about it. Mm. It was whispered, but it was shameful. It was considered shameful. And, you know, you didn't know what other people were going to say. And so I so appreciate that in your family, it was embraced.
Yeah, that is very true. I mean, they, you know, again, you know, the woman in the cloak to all of us seemed clearly to be Mary, and, you know, whatever the voice was my mother heard. I mean, at that time, to me, it was irrefutably God, you know, or a saint or someone powerfully talking to her from the other side of the veil. So, I mean, I think we all just accepted it as that. But my mother and my aunt and my grandma preserved these stories, you know, I mean, care took them, but shared them, you know, very openly with us, you know, definitely. And that, and I am, you're right, I am grateful for that, because there have been moments in my own life when things like that have happened. And, you know, I decide, of course, carefully when and with whom I will share it. But, you know, I've shared some things with my daughters and, you know, my husband or closest friends. And there's absolutely, it feels, they all feel like tremendous gifts. There's definitely nothing shameful for me or embarrassing about that, which you're right, that is a gift too. And, you know, from the way it was presented to me.
And I think what's important about that, you sharing these stories, your ancestors sharing these stories, is that it allows the children or those who are around to understand that there's magic out there, that miracles can happen every day, and that there's beauty in the world. It might be unexpected, but it's there. And that's why I love that your family shared all these stories.
Yeah. Yeah, I totally agree with you.
Much to all of you for listening to another episode of the podcast. I love doing this show. And if you haven't already, please, please consider writing a review or leaving a rating wherever you find the podcast. You have no idea how much those ratings and those reviews help other people find us. I need to thank Catherine for sharing her poetry, for sharing her stories. Her latest gorgeous book, Point of Entry, will be found on the treasures page of the website, and that's bitesizedblessings.com for you all. On the website, you'll find links to other books, to other creators, to music and art that I hope lightens and brightens your day. I need to thank the creators of the music used in this episode, for without it, this podcast would be seriously boring. Frank Schroeder, Alexander Nakarada, Dudu, Music L Files, Justin Allen Arnold, and Sasha End. For complete attribution, please see the Bite-Sized Blessings website at bitesizedblessings.com. Thank you for listening, and here's my one request. Be like Catherine. Live deeply into the stories of your family, your ancestors. We wouldn't be here without those formidable human beings who went before us, who crossed oceans for new adventures, who did things at the time which would have been thought impossible. Live into their bravery, their belief in beautiful, impossible worlds, and then take that bravery and that impossible belief in better worlds and remind everyone around you that it is possible. We can be brave. We can create beauty in this world. And soon, so very soon, you'll become a force of nature in your own right.